From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, talking about his generation, we meet Pete Townshend, the guitarist and lead songwriter of The Who. His rock opera Tommy is now a Broadway hit. Last Thursday was the 15th anniversary of the mass suicide led by cult leader Jim Jones. Over 900 of his followers died in his Guyana settlement known as Jonestown. We talk with his only surviving biological son, Stephen Jones. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Reckless Appetites, a new novel about romance and recipes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is warning North Korea again that the communist country faces increased world pressure if it doesn't allow international nuclear inspectors to look at its weapons sites. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Without spelling out what incentives he was offering North Korea, the president said that if North Korea abandoned its plans to develop a nuclear bomb, the door would be open on a wide range of issues. And he warned the North Koreans again that any attack on the South would be met by a massive U.S. military response. According to a senior administration official, the situation with North Korea is growing more urgent because the International Atomic Energy Agency is close to having to declare that it can no longer certify that North Korea is complying with international safeguards regarding nuclear weapons. If that happens, administration officials say, the president would have little choice but to call for action by the United Nations Security Council. Last week, Secretary of State Warren Christopher suggested that economic sanctions could be the next step. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says he'll call members back to Washington after Thanksgiving to force them to act on the Brady handgun control measure. Versions of the bill have been passed by both the House and Senate, but Republican leader Bob Dole objected to a voice vote on the compromise, saying the measure was negotiated in bad faith. Dole said today that he plans to offer another alternative next week. That could stall the measure still further because the new version would have to be approved by the House. And House Speaker Thomas Foley says he doesn't plan to call the representatives back. The United Nations official in charge of overseeing the human rights situation in Iraq says Baghdad is still repressing Shiites in the south of the country and Kurds in the north. Max von der Stuhl is calling for international pressure to force Iraq to change. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Van der Stuhl said that despite the imposition of a no-fly zone over southern Iraq, the situation of Shiites living in the marshes is deteriorating. He says the regime continues to launch indiscriminate artillery bombardments of Shiite villages.
The claim of the Iraqi regimes that the whole operation is simply directed against saboteurs, infiltrators, deserters simply doesn't hold waters. The whole population suffers as a consequence of the Iraqi military actions.
At the same time, the regime is trying to persuade the Security Council to lift the UN oil embargo. Van der Stuhl urges that the Council consider Iraq's human rights record before deciding to lift the embargo. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,674. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 8.7 to close at 746.8. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. UN officials in Sarajevo say that two aid convoys are now on their way to central Bosnia. The lines of trucks are the first to be sent to the area in 4 weeks. UN officials said they're confident the convoys will be allowed to pass through the lines of the warring factions. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is anxious to restart aid to nearly 800,000 people in central Bosnia, where UN food stocks are said to be nearly exhausted. The government's guide for analyzing the nutritional content of federal food programs might not have the most accurate information. Handbook 8 is being criticized in a new congressional study that says it needs better research methods. NPR's Laura Kanoy has details.
Nearly 24 federal agencies use Handbook 8 to judge the nutrition content of programs like school lunches, meals for the military, and for veterans hospitals. The information is also used for research on how Americans eat. A new General Accounting Office report says the Agriculture Department, which publishes the handbook, relies too much on undocumented research from food companies and other outside sources. For example, the fast food industry provided most of the handbook's information on the fat, calorie, and nutrition content of bacon cheeseburgers. The Agriculture Department says it will improve Handbook 8 as quickly as possible, noting that Congress has cut funding for nutrition research almost every year for the past 12 years. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Officials of American Airlines say they expect to be operating at full capacity soon. A spokesman said the airline is operating at about 60% of its normal traffic today after striking flight attendants returned to work. Airline Vice President Bob Baker told reporters that he couldn't say whether all the strikers are now guaranteed jobs. He said that will have to await the outcome of binding arbitration that the two sides agreed to yesterday. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Pete Townsend, co-founded The Who and was its guitarist and main songwriter. The group was founded in 1964 in London and soon became a voice of teenage rebellion with anthems like Townsend's song My Generation. This song has his most famous line, "Hope I die before I get old."
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things ain't do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Townsend's rebellious energy was expressed not only in his songs, but in his power chords and in the way he'd smash his guitar at the end of his concerts. Even people who don't know much about The Who are aware of their rock opera Tommy, about the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who became a pinball wizard. The 1969 album was later adapted into a film by Ken Russell, and now it's a Broadway hit. There's even a new Tommy coffee table book that Townsend has contributed to. Before Townsend decided to take Tommy to Broadway, he broke his wrist in a bicycle accident, which left him temporarily unable to play.
The wrist injury was a life-changing thing for me. It changed a whole lot of things, and because it was so in the short term, immediately after the accident, it was so devastating. I couldn't write, I couldn't type, I certainly couldn't play any musical instrument, It was a very, very complicated fracture, and I had no idea whether physiotherapy was going to get what kind of movement I was going to get back, and all the signs were that it was going to be a long, drawn out process of maybe 5 years with maybe three or four operations, so I was kind of looking at, you know, and I suppose in a way I was already in semi-retirement. I had a career as a solo artist, but you know, I didn't. You know, it's not something that takes up an immense amount of time, and I'd you know, I just had time to stop and look at what was happening in my life and who I was and who I wanted to be and you know, how much I really cared about not being able to play and how much I really cared about not being able to write and that kind of thing, and around that time, Pace Theatrical of Houston rang me and set up a meeting with Des Makinoff.
The director of...
That's right, yeah. And I think, because I had space in my life, but also, I suppose, a void in my life at the time, you know, a gulf stretching into the future, I actually felt... You know, it just felt fortuitous. You know, it felt like it was... a divine intervention.
So how much has your wrist healed?
It seems to be okay.
Can you play now?
Yeah, I've done a tour this year. I did a tour, a solo tour. I did about 15 shows, 10 to 15 shows, I can't remember. Maybe it was actually, a lucky 13, I think. And I had really good fun. I played everything that I wanted to play, and I play slightly differently now, I think.
How so?
Because the actual flexibility of the wrist is reduced. Mm. I can't do those kind of flourishing, very, very fast flamenco-y things holding a plectrum, which is part of the kind of not just the distinction of the way that I play, but also a vanity, you know, personal vanity. Nobody else that I know was ever able to do that. And now I can't do it either. So
when you hurt your arm and you say you asked yourself how much you cared about not being able to play, how much did you care?
I didn't care very much. I really didn't. I think it was really quite sobering in a way to realise that. I thought I was going to miss being able to sit around with a guitar and entertain myself. But I immediately started to learn to write longhand with my left hand. And by the time my right hand started to work, I was almost completely left-handed. Take something away from somebody and it makes you revalue everything else that you've got. And I think that's what I did. So no, I'm not trying to be callous or hard or indifferent to my talent, but that was the space I was in. I was kind of in a space where I wasn't really worrying so much about what I'd lost, but I was very interested in what I'd gained. And I had a very clear list of things to do, 100 things to do, you know, while you can't play the guitar. And one of the things at the very, very bottom of the list, and I managed to actually get through this list in about a week. One of the things at the bottom of the list was go and see Mum, my mother, and ask her about the lost years.
The lost years?
The lost years.
The years when you were with your grandparents?
Yeah.
Well, it was your parents were on the road, I think. Your father was a musician.
Yeah.
And well, you spent, when you were about 5 to 7, you were with your grandparents.
That's right. Not with my grandparents. I was with my grandmother, who was a single woman. Mm-hmm. She actually deserted my mother when she was married.
Why was it so important to you to feel? What did you need to know about that?
Well,
time?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember anything, and I couldn't remember very much about those years. All I could remember was really quite unpleasant things, and I wanted to know. So I went to see my mother, and I said, "Listen, don't give me any details. Don't give me any stuff. Don't give me any emotion. Just give me facts. I want to know where I was on, you know, June the 1st, where I was on June the 2nd, and because I said, you know, let me. Digest that, and then I'll come back later and ask you about the emotional stuff, the personal stuff, and the reasons. And whenever she did, I ran a tape machine, and whenever she digressed, I got her back on track and said, "No, listen, just stick to the facts and help me, because you know." And she's been preparing material about her own life. She's trying to write a book about her own life, and so a lot of the stuff was fairly fresh in her mind, but.
So did this, were there revelations for you in what she told you?
Yeah. I mean, shocking revelations.
Like what? I don't know if you'd care to share them or not.
I can't really share them.
That's fine.
But what I realized was is that some of the memories that I did have of my childhood, that stopped, you know, where you know, you kind of go into a dark tunnel and you can't see what's at the other end of a memory. I'd actually remembered them in my work, that my writing was the memory that still functioned. You know, I've even been in therapy and, confronted or come to that point where I've actually tried to, you know, remember that stuff. And my therapist once said to me, I'm not in therapy anymore, I did it for 3 years. Write it down, you know, write it down. Write down what happened. And when you come to the point that you can't remember, just keep writing. And when I sat down to start writing, I started to get this incredible feeling of dread. And it was so enormous that I just broke down. And I realized that if I continued to try to remember, I would actually have a kind of nervous breakdown and decided not to go on. You know, and I don't think, and what's interesting is just so that people don't think this is the Oprah Winfrey show. the reason why I can't talk about what happened is that I don't think it's particularly significant. Comparison to the terrible, terrible things that have happened to people that I know and that people that I read about. But its effect on me was enormous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't mean to suggest deep, dark secrets necessarily.
Right.
A curious kind of, you know, definitely a curious byproduct of being the child of of not only two very young people who were born in the war, met in the war and married in the Air Force, and you know, my father was very glamorous, wonderful looking, looked like a film star. My mother was a very sexy, well dressed young girl, and you know, that I think, you know, I came along very, very quickly. I think my mother, you know, conceived me like within about a week of their marriage, and there I was, you know, and I think, you know, he was out on the road, still young, having fun, and my mother had been a singer in a band, and I think she just wanted some time to herself, so she hung with me for about 2.5-3 years, and they were such fantastic years. You know, I was out on the road with my mum and dad, and I was with them all the time, and I, yeah, you know, I used to sleep in between them. You know, I was in the way, I was there, I was the, you know, I was the star of the show, I was on the stage. I can remember show business, and then it just goes black.
Well, how did show business look to you when you were young and your parents were on the road? Was that the kind of life you thought you might want for yourself sometime?
Oh, there was no question. That was what I was going to do.
That's what you wanted.
Yeah, no, it wasn't what I wanted. It's what I had. It was where I was. It's like, you know, this is Liza Minnelli and Lorna Luft, you know, except that for me, it was both mum and dad there all the time. And this extended family, it's a big dance orchestra, you know, with like 26 members.
But your father played clarinet?
Clarinet and saxophone, yeah.
And your mother sang?
Yeah, yeah.
No, before rock, and before you seriously took up guitar, you liked trad jazz, and I think you even played banjo before you got serious about the guitar. What did you prefer about jazz during the period that you were into that and didn't listen to that much rock?
Oh, this is a neat conjunction. It was the fact that it connected more with my father and the kind of music that he played. The band used to play a Dixieland set in the show, which was very popular when I was a teenager. This is my father's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was a concession to the young people, you know, the crazy young people who like that jazz stuff, because most of it was ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So this was a sort of 20-minute set, and my father played lead clarinet, and I used to love that because this seemed to me to be, you know, where, this was pre my discovery of rock and roll. And had I been exposed, you know, to, I don't know, John Lee Hooker or Hank Williams or any of those kind of early, or even Pete Seeger or any of those people that were kind of defining how the song was going to become a rock song, and, you know, how the song of those three different distinct forms of popular music would come together as the rock song 10 years later. If I'd have heard that music, I don't know whether I would have responded to it at all. I had no context for it. So I think, you know, the trad jazz thing was just, you know, it was something that grew out of my need to mm-hmm. do something that connected with my dad, who I worshipped.
Pete Townsend is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Pete Townsend. You went to art school, though. Did you have artistic aspirations, in the visual arts?
Well, I'm actually quite good at painting, and my visual eye is quite good. You know, I designed all the Who's early clothes, and you know and posters and things like that, logos and. I'm quite good in that area, but mm-hmm. actually before I actually played the guitar, you know, from the ages of about, from 8 upwards to about 12, I wanted to be a journalist. And I think that actually informed the way that I think probably more than being an artist. What going to art school did for me was not finish me off as an artist, because the course that I went to turned out to be a really crazy course. It actually turned me into a radical. It's the same course that David Bowie did. It's the same course that Brian Eno did. A deconstructionist kind of English Bauhaus course called the basic course, produced by a bunch of English artists who wanted to radicalize art school teaching.
Now, let me ask you about the beginnings of your music. Having come to rock and roll after being interested in jazz, after having played guitar, after having worshipped your father who played clarinet, when you started playing rock and roll, you really cranked up the volume and started using feedback and distortion, getting really far away from the sounds you were first interested in. Can you tell me why you became so interested in volume and distortion?
Well, there are a couple of different things. I mean, there's a sort of a sociologist in me on this subject, and I think and if I can actually talk about Jim Marshall as an example here, I won't talk about me. Let me talk about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall's father was a boxer. Jim Marshall is the man who invented the Marshall amplifier, you know, the big stack that the Who used, that mm-hmm. Eric Clapton used, that Jimi Hendrix adopted when he came to the UK, that big wall of sound thing. And Jim had a music shop. And one day, I went in and we'd been playing at pubs. And I said, I've got these two American amplifiers, Jim. I've got a Fender Pro Amp and a Fender Bassman Amp. And I said, they're great amplifiers. They sound great. And I was already using a certain amount of feedback. And I said, but the trouble is that I can hear the audience. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can hear them. You know, I mean, if I'm playing and somebody's in the front row and they say, this is junk, I can hear what they're saying. I don't want to hear them, okay? And I said, so I need something bigger and louder. And his eyes lit up. And I said, can you do this for me? And he said, and he got his engineer out and he said, do you think you can do this? And the guy said, yeah, I think I can do it. You know, I can do it. I think I can do it. And I realized at that moment that what was actually happening was that I was demanding a more powerful machine gun. And Jim Marshall was going to build it for me. And then we were going to go out and blow people away all around the world. And the generation we were going to blow away was the generation immediately preceding us, the ones who had the gall to tell us that we were wimps because we had long hair, wimps because we didn't have wars to fight in, wimps because we couldn't prove ourselves in military service because we didn't have it, you know, it was not necessary anymore. We were post-atomic bomb people, that we were wimps, 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 and that the only reason that we even had electric guitars and rock and roll was because they'd paved the way for peace and given everything up, which is, of course, absolutely true they had. You know, and Remembrance Day is a day that I take very seriously. It's just past. You know, I do remember those guys that gave us this peace. And I cry for them. But I think that anger was something that really crossed over generations. It wasn't just from rock and roll. It just wasn't from me and my need to smash guitars. It was right over the whole industry, right through the whole of show business and rock and roll and the media and everybody. Everybody of that generation wanted it to be bigger, louder, and wanted it to be as big as the atomic bomb had been.
Now, how do you connect this to smashing guitars?
I think the connection isn't actually, you would call it in CD-ROM talk, you would call it a hyperlink. I don't think it's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. I think it's a byproduct of stage performance. I think, you know, you know, the first guitar that I broke in front of my grandmother, when I was 14.
Were you impressing her, or was this a mistake?
No. It was another take on the Jim Marshall story. She bought me my first guitar, which was a piece of trash. Uh-huh. And I was very upset because my father had recommended the guitar because I couldn't play the clarinet, and I wanted him to buy the guitar. So I was angry that she bought me this piece of trash, and it was very, very hard to play. And my dad said, well, you know, she has bought it for you. She is your grandmother. Try and learn to play something on it. And if you can, then I'll buy you a new one. And this went on and on and on and on. And one day I'm clunking away at this horrible kind of guitar, which was really fit only to be hung on the wall at an Italian restaurant next to the Chianti bottles. And I think that's where it probably came from. And she came in and she said, this is a bloody awful row, you know, why don't you play some proper music? And I said, listen, Nan, we know what we're doing, you know, leave us alone. And I was with John Entwistle, who was, you know, we were little kids, really. And she said, no, turn it off, it's a bloody horrible row. So, and she said, if you don't turn it off, I'll smash it. So I said, "No, you won't smash it." And I got the guitar, and I smashed it over the amplifier. I broke an amplifier at the same time too, a little kind of tiny amplifier, and she went completely white and walked out of the room. And John said, "You've done it now," and I said, "I might have." I said, "But John, I feel great." And of course, I was able then to, you know, to go and look for a decent guitar and rob and steal to get it, which is what I did, and found myself a decent instrument. And from there on, I never looked back. Really.
Yeah, but once you had a good instrument, why did you smash that on stage?
Guitars are very good for me to express myself by smashing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good for me to express myself by playing them. They're very good for express myself by pouring lighter fluid over them and warming my hands. You know, it depends what I'm doing. You know.
But let me ask you, how did the feeling you had the first time you smashed a guitar on stage compare to the feeling you had like the 100th time or the 200th time you'd done it? Did it still feel as good? Did it feel good in a different way?
I don't think it's ever felt good at all. I don't think it's something that I expected to feel good.
I mean, good in the sense of a release.
I don't think it's ever felt good as a sense of a release. I don't, you know, I'm afraid it's too, it's always been too, you know, I've always used the instrument that I happen to be playing at the time. And I mean, as I see it splinter, I'm thinking, oh my God, $1,000. But, you know, I've actually been enough of an artist and believed in the act enough to do it again and again and again.
Well, what does the act mean to you?
It means a number of things. I think it's a statement mainly of artistic independence. I mean, it's also an act of. It's in the same tone as, you know, as you know, we want our amplifiers to be loud so that we can't hear the response. It's like saying, "Okay, the show is over. Now, I am finished." And in a sense that all music is over now, everything to do with this particular event is over now. It's finished. You know, the interaction between me, you and this guitar is over now. It's a big dramatic action. And the reason that it has to, in a way, be theatrically violent, because I think that's as far as it gets. It's, you know, we used to smash our equipment up and then go back and drink, you know, cups of lemon tea. Like, I think that the reason that it needs to be theatrically violent is in a way that it is because the observation that the thing that we're trying, you know, get out of the you know to the response that we want from the audience is one of absolute reflection at that moment on everything that's happened up to that point. You know, to stun them, to actually stop them.
Well, I really wish we had more time to talk, but we have to wrap up. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For being with us. Pete Townsend's rock opera Tommy is now a Broadway hit. There's also a new book called The Who's Tommy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If your child ain't all he should be now, this girl can put him right. I'll show him what he could be now. Just give me one night. I'm the gypsy, the acid queen. Pay before we start. The gypsy. Give us a room, close the door, leave us for a while. Your boy won't be a boy no more, young but not a child. I'm the gypsy, the acid queen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fifteen years ago, cult leader Jim Jones ordered the suicide of more than 900 of his followers in his Guyana settlement known as Jonestown. His son Stephen happened to be away from the compound that day. Coming up, we talk with Stephen Jones about trying to figure out what happened and why. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel called Reckless Appetites by Jacqueline Duval. If the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, what should you serve? That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House and Senate have not adjourned as yet because of a deadlock over the so-called Brady Bill. Senate Republicans are blocking a vote in the final measure because they say that it was negotiated in bad faith. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
First introduced 7 years ago and passed by both the House and Senate once again this year, the Brady Bill still may not become law. Senate Republicans refused to vote on the final version of the bill, negotiated by a bipartisan group of lawmakers. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole says opponents of the Brady Bill got the shaft in the end, and their provisions were stripped out. Dole, acting on behalf of Western state Republicans, who are strong opponents of the bill, made it clear, however, he wants some version of the measure to pass, an indication of the political heat he's taking for the stalling. Close to 90% of Americans now support the measure, once considered to be controversial, although a majority doubt that it will have much impact on violent crime. Senate Democrats are using the opportunity to say that Republicans are once again the party of gridlock. This is a filibuster, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell declared on the Senate floor. Make no mistake about it. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton has denied that U.S. policies toward North Korea have eased. At a news conference, Mr. Clinton said, however, to seek economic sanctions against North Korea is not a very attractive option in getting the country to open up its nuclear facilities to international inspections. Last week in Seattle, Secretary of State Warren Christopher indicated that sanctions were under consideration. The president said that the U.S. and South Korea are ready to resolve once and for all their differences with North Korea if the communist government resumes talks with the South and allow outside inspections. For passengers and American Airlines, on-time flights have been the rule today, with flight attendants back at work after an end of their 5-day strike. Now the air carrier is gearing up for a busy holiday weekend. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
Throughout the day, American Airlines has experienced few cancellations or delays at Miami International Airport, one of its 7 hub facilities. Here, officials say, operations are now fully restored. Company spokeswoman Pat San Pedro says American will be operating its full system-wide schedule of 2,600 flights to 200 cities very soon.
And people are getting on board the airplanes. I think by the time Thanksgiving comes around, we should be pretty much back to normal with everyone going to where they need to go for the holidays.
Flight attendants had planned to stay on strike through the weekend, but agreed to go back to work yesterday when the Clinton administration persuaded their union and American to settle their contract differences through binding arbitration. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 4 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Government officials in Germany have agreed to pull 400 of its 1,700 troops in Somalia out in the near future. A spokesman for German Chancellor Kohl said the cabinet will decide in 1 month's time the future of the mission that started in July, in Germany's efforts to expand the nation's military role in the UN. However, this move came under strong criticism at home. The German mission was first sent to northern Somalia to give ground support to Indian peacekeepers, but the Indian force was sent someplace else. A key government advisory board has rejected a proposal to change guidelines for when women should start getting mammograms to look for breast cancer. A National Cancer Institute board has reaffirmed a recommendation that women should start getting mammograms at the age of 40. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
In 1988, the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, and 10 other organizations put out a joint recommendation that women should start getting routine mammograms at the age of 40. But recently, several studies have failed to show that women under 50 benefit from mammography. So, the National Cancer Institute considered changing its official recommendation to start at age 50. But the American Cancer Society argued against changing the recommendations. They say it can't hurt to start earlier, and it might help. This difference of opinion caused a rift among experts and confusion among women. But a board at the National Cancer Institute decided to patch things up by keeping the recommendations as they are, starting at age 40. In the best tradition of science, the Cancer Institute called for more research. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
OPEC oil ministers have ended their meeting in Vienna with no agreement on a move to cut production and raise prices. The 12 oil ministers are to meet again tomorrow. There have been various news reports that OPEC will make a 2 or 3% cut in oil production over the amount agreed to in September. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 15 years ago, nearly everyone Stephen Jones knew died in a mass suicide led by his father. Stephen Jones is the only surviving biological son of cult leader Jim Jones. Over 900 of Jim Jones's followers died after he ordered them to drink cyanide-laced punch on November 18, 1978. This tragedy came a day after a delegation, led by California Congressman Leo Ryan, came to investigate charges that Jones was holding people against their will at his Guyana settlement known as Jonestown. Later that day, Ryan, three reporters, and one defector were shot by Jones's followers. Stephen Jones and two of his brothers were away from the compound that week. That is perhaps the only reason they are alive today. The New Yorker has a story about these surviving brothers in the November 22nd issue. I spoke to Stephen Jones, who is now 34. He went down to Guyana as part of an advance team before his father arrived with his followers in 1977. I asked Stephen if he wanted to go to Guyana.
I was actually coerced into going because I was on my way out of the temple. The article explains the circumstances that surrounded that. And so my father asked me to make one last trip, and I refused. But he went through my mother and agreed or told her that he wouldn't keep me down there. And because of that, she agreed to ask me to go, and I went, and he kept me down there. I do want to add, though, that once there, separated from him, because he didn't come down for some time after that. Some of the happiest, they were the happiest years of my life up to that point. I was very much at home in the jungle and appreciated my freedom. We worked very hard, but before my father got there, it was productive labor, and we accomplished a lot of young people, and we ate well, and it was definitely challenging, but it was something that I was up to and relished.
So what you were doing was clearing the land, preparing for the new settlement.
Yeah, well, not only that was my primary function, but I also, you know, we also were building the community, building mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. cottages and the dormitories.
You say your father kept you there. How did he keep you there?
Well, he didn't really provide me means to leave, and strongly requested that I stay. I suppose if I had wanted to run through the jungle and work my way out, and I could have done that, but it's not an easy thing to leave a community in the heart of the tropical forest.
Your brother Jim, your adopted brother, was, I believe, a top lieutenant in your father's security squad. Were you expected to be an enforcer also?
I think they liked having that to be the perception. There were times that I even reveled in the image of being strong and someone to be reckoned with and feared. But as we neared the end, not knowing that we were nearing the end, actually thinking we were nearing the end of Jim Jones's reign, but not the end of our lives as we knew it, that no longer was something that was reality, and it's certainly not something that I wanted.
Did you have to spy on other people?
No, I was never asked to do that. He had people spying on me.
What were they spying? What did they find when they spied on you?
What did they find? Well, there was one occasion where I had a passbook and means to leave the town should I ever want to that was given to me by my mother, and people went through my stuff and took it and turned it into my father. What else did they find? I don't think they would ever find anything when spying on me, because my intention was, it was never my intention to leave or run from Jonestown, because that was my community. That was all I knew. I think something that people don't realize, perhaps, when they think about it initially, is that People's Temple is not something I chose. It was my life. And any changes that I made or would ever make would have been from within. So there was really nothing to find. I think what they were doing primarily was just keeping an eye on me and finding out who I was talking to so that they'd know who else they needed to keep an eye on.
Were you punished?
From time to time, yeah. I got away with a lot more than anybody else would have gotten away with, that's for sure.
What were you punished for, and what were the punishments like?
I was primarily punished for public displays of rebellion. And I had a violent temper, and I exhibited it in a number of ways. If it wasn't fighting, rarely with anyone in the temple, but fighting with someone on the street or getting into a shouting match with and questioning or challenging something that I felt was unfair and taking it to the extreme and then being told to stop by my father and continuing it, which is the greatest of transgressions. It was that kind of thing. And the way I was punished normally is by spanking, public spanking.
Were there a lot of public spankings, or is this just for you?
Oh, no, there were a lot of them. There were a number of ways that people were made an example of, and public spanking was one of them.
Your father made it really clear in Jonestown that he had a big sexual appetite that needed to be filled, and that your mother couldn't fill it. What was it like for you as his son to watch him do that in such a public way? Did it seem, I just would like to know how you felt about it.
God, I haven't looked back on that much, and when I do, I think that I'd have to say that I had steeled myself to it long before it really got out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I divorced myself from my father in so many ways. Reality was something that I often suspended while in the temple.
My guest is Stephen Jones, the surviving biological son of cult leader Jim Jones. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Jones is my guest. Did you see a change in your father toward the end at Jonestown? Did he become more paranoid, more out of touch?
No. I mean, he was pretty paranoid. Well, yeah, it got really bad towards the end. It's ironic because I was certain at the time, and I still believe to this day, that it was only a matter of months before Jim Jones would completely incapacitate himself on drugs and whatever else he was doing. So yeah, things did intensify. He was pretty paranoid and delusional for a lot of years prior to November 18th, 1978. But But yeah, things things were really coming to a head when the congressman visited.
Congressman Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
You and two of your brothers were gone the day of the mass suicide. You were actually in another town in Guyana playing in a basketball game. Is that
right?
Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that your father intentionally organized the mass suicide for a day when you and two of your stepbrothers would be gone?
No, I don't. For a number of reasons. One is he instructed us to return. I don't know if he knew that things would end the way they did. I'm sure that he was contemplating it. We certainly didn't believe that he'd go through with it, having experienced so many rehearsals in the past. We'd come to think of him as the little boy who cried wolf. I certainly didn't believe my father. My father was afraid of his own shadow. I never believed he would take his own life, and we refused to come back. So, and it was quite a fight for us to even leave Jonestown to come in and play basketball. So, that just doesn't make sense if he was if it was his intention to get us away from town so that he could do what he did.
Say when your father urged you to return to Jonestown, you had gone back, and you were there the day of the mass suicide. Do you have any sense what you would have done?
That's so tough. That is... one, I think it's a waste for me to spend too much time thinking about what I might have done,
mm-hmm.
Because it's irrelevant. But I know that there were a lot of strong people there. There were a number of people who had a strong dislike for my father, who lost their lives there. My mother, by accounts that were given to me by two people who ran, witnessed what was happening there, fought, struggled until the last baby died, and then walked up resolutely and took the poison herself. And she's one of the strongest people I've known, and she certainly was not a blind follower of Jim Jones. That's all I know. And with that, I have to say that it would do a huge disservice to the people that lost their lives there for me to say that I would have done anything different. I just don't know.
Do you think you would have been willing to take your own life?
No. I mean, that's not... But like I said, I can think of a lot of people there that weren't real big on suicide who are dead now.
Stephen, do you think your father was mad? And do you worry as his biological son of anything, you know, genetic being passed on? People talk about a genetic tendency toward schizophrenia and other problems.
No, I don't worry. I'm sorry. I'm only hesitating because I'm smiling, and the reason I'm smiling is I've heard that so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
Does it make you angry when you hear it, too?
No, it doesn't make me angry. It doesn't. Where did the question start? I think my father was mad.
Yeah.
I think my father was disturbed. From very early on, there were some real problems. Do I think I share those tendencies genetically? No. Do I believe that all of us are very complex and that we are, in many ways, the sum of the horrible and the wonderful? Yes, I do. But I also believe that we choose what side of us and what part of us will represent us and what we will play in life with. And I think my father was overwhelmed and gave in far too many times to the side of him that is horrible.
I have one other question I want to ask you. Do you think your father loved you? Is this something that you think about a lot?
Yeah, I think my father loved me. I now love my father.
Now that's going to sound funny to a lot of people. You know, a man who was very disturbed, very paranoid, who was responsible for over 900 deaths, who probably would have presided over your death had you been there. And you're saying you love him.
Yeah, I love him. I think it's important to all of us to really take ownership of our heritage and our past, and recognize that it has contributed to what we are today, and that forgiveness and love are extremely powerful tools. And as long as I hold hatred and pain from what my father has done to me, I will remain his victim. And not until I was able to forgive him and again love him was I truly free.
Now, did this come after years of therapy or just a lot of introspection?
A lot of introspection.
Therapy?
No therapy. Well, not in the clinical sense. Not that I'm close to that, but it happened in many ways. It happened in dreams. It happened just in life. Recognizing my own frailties and my own potential for ugliness,
mm-hmm.
and also recognizing my real potential for good, and owning that they were all a part of me. And getting back to what I said before is that, you know, I decide. I have to choose what's going to rule my life and how I'm going to use the many parts of me. And knowing that I've got all of that within me, it's easier for me to reconcile with my father.
Stephen Jones, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Stephen Jones spoke to us from San Francisco, where he runs a furniture installation business. He and his wife recently had their first child. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on American Airlines flying again?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report on the end of the strike. American Airlines officials say they hope to fly 85% of their flights tomorrow. The Winchester Ammunition Company announces it will withdraw its Black Talon bullets. These are 9-millimeter high-powered bullets. They'll take them off the market. The company says the ammunition is now a focal point for issues that go beyond the control of Winchester Ammunition. Also, President Clinton meets today with the president of South Korea, Kim Jong-sam, and Robert Siegel talks with the author of Pump and Circumstance, A History of the Gas Station in America.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The enormous popularity of the recent book and movie Like Water for Chocolate illustrates a truth about human nature that owners of dinner theaters have known. People are more receptive to art when it's accompanied by food. The latest literary example of this is Jacqueline Duval's new novel, Reckless Appetites. It's subtitled A Culinary Romance. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
There's an agonized passage in one of Lord Byron's letters that anticipates the regrets and the feeble resolutions many of us are going to be making by, say, about 4 o'clock this Thursday afternoon. Byron writes, "I wish to God I had not dined now. It kills me with heaviness, stupor, and horrible dreams. I wish I were in the country to take exercise. I will not be the slave of any appetite." Yeah, I bet you 3 hours after Byron wrote that letter, he was in the kitchen fixing himself a turkey club sandwich. The power of food to make fools of us all is something the great minds have long pondered. As G.K. Chesterton once said of a pork chop, "Science can analyze it, but science cannot analyze any man's wish for a pork chop and say how much of it is hunger, how much nervous fancy, how much a haunting love of the beautiful. In Jacqueline Duval's comic novel, Reckless Appetites, she doesn't presume to answer the Sphinx riddle of why food, glorious food, holds us in such thrall. Nor does she bother to give us a meaty plot or fully fleshed out characters. What Duval does do, however, is to serve up a narrative menu of over 100 recipes and luscious quotes about food taken from the works of writers like Langston Hughes, Dorothy Wordsworth, and Proust. As novels go, Reckless Appetites is very light fare. Think of it as tofu-y for the brain, an amusing book to read if you're not in the mood to digest anything that's likely to repeat on you. The heroine of Reckless Appetites is a sly young French woman named Pomme, that translates into apple in English. As her name biblically suggests, Pomme is a temptress, but she's failing miserably with the current object of her desire, an aloof Englishman named Jeremy. Pomme, who's studying to be a chef, decides to search literature high and low for the perfect food and the perfect words to kindle romance. Not surprisingly, the voluptuous writer Colette supplies most of the ideas on Pomme's seductive shopping list. Colette's description of dark chocolate slowly melting over cherries soaked in cognac would make a gargoyle pant. But it's even more fun to read the literary recipes Pomme wisely rejects, like Mrs. Charles Dickens's special potato balls made with cold codfish. Guaranteed, Mrs. Dickens naively wrote, to keep a husband at home. Or D.H. Lawrence's surefire aphrodisiac of bull testicle pie. Yum, yum. When the love affair between Jeremy and Pomme curdles, she turns to Zora Neale Hurston for a great revenge recipe, gumbo thickened with bad vinegar and beef gall. Duval augments the skimpy romantic storyline here by wheeling in other kinds of texts. In addition to the plentiful recipes and quotes, there are letters, articles about the history of coffee and hashish, and even footnotes and a bibliography of books about food. Like a lot of novelists these days, Jacqueline Duval is borrowing a dodgy technique perfected by academic writers. That is, the fewer ideas of your own you have, the more of other people's you quote. But in Reckless Appetites, the reheated literary leftovers are juicy, crisp, and flavorful. It's the new stuff that sometimes tastes a little like cardboard.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Reckless Appetites by Jacqueline Duval, published by Echo Press. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, Lord, I want to eat it. Eat that chicken. Eat that chicken pie. Oh, Lord, I do.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Forget Iron John. What does Garrison Keillor have to say about men? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Keillor about his new collection of stories, The Book of Guys. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.